and he decided he could trust her. Handing her the rope, he said, "In that case, you can take her to Minakuchi, or even to Kusatsu if you want. All I ask is that you send her back." As they started away, Jotaro, in high dudgeon, exclaimed, "How do you like that? He treated me like an ass, and then as soon as he saw a pretty face..." "You'd better be careful what you say about the old man. His horse is listening. She may get angry and throw you." "Do you think this feeble-jointed old nag can get the best of me?" "You don't know how to ride, do you?" "Of course I know how to ride." "What are you doing then, trying to climb up from behind?" "Well, help me up!" "You're a nuisance." She put her hands under his armpits and lifted him onto the animal. Jotaro looked majestically around at the world beneath him. "Please, walk ahead, Otsu," he said. "You're not sitting right." "Don't worry, I'm fine." "All right, but you're going to be sorry." Taking the rope in one hand, Otsu waved goodbye to the proprietor with the other, and the two started off. Before they had gone 100 paces, they heard a loud shout coming out of the mist behind them, accompanied by the sound of running footsteps. "Who could that be?" asked Jotaro. "Is he calling us?" wondered Otsu. They stopped the horse and looked around. The shadow of a man began to take form in the white, smoky mist. At first they could make out only contours, then colors, but the man was soon close enough for them to discern his general appearance and approximate age. A diabolic aura surrounded his body, as though he were accompanied by a raging whirlwind. He came rapidly to Otsu's side, halted, and with one swift motion snatched the rope from her hand. "Get off!" he commanded, glaring up at Jotaro. The horse skittered backward. Clutching her mane, Jotaro shouted, "You can't do this! I rented this horse, not you!" The man snorted, turned to Otsu, and said, "You, woman!" "Yes?" Otsu said in a low voice.
"My name's Shishido Baiken. I live in Uji Village, up in the mountains beyond the barrier. For reasons I won't go into, I'm after a man named Miyamoto Musashi. He came along this road sometime before daybreak this morning, probably passed here hours ago, so I've got to move fast if I'm going to catch him in Yasugawa on the Omi border. Let me have your horse."
He talked very rapidly, his ribs heaving in and out. In the cold air, the mist was condensing into icy flowers on branches and twigs, but his neck glistened like a snakeskin with sweat. Otsu stood very still, her face deathly white, as though the earth beneath her had drained all the blood from her body. Her lips quivering, she wanted desperately to ask and make sure that she had heard correctly. She couldn't utter a word.
"You said Musashi?"
Jotaro blurted out. He was still clutching the horse's mane, but his arms and legs were trembling. Baiken was in too much of a hurry to notice their shocked reaction.
"Come on now," he ordered. "Off the horse, and be quick about it, or I'll give you a thrashing."
He brandished the end of the rope like a whip. Jotaro shook his head adamantly.
"I won't!" "What do you mean you won't?"
"It's my horse. You can't have it. I don't care how much of a hurry you're in."
"Watch it. I've been very nice and explained everything, because you're only a woman and a child traveling alone, but..."
"Isn't that right, Otsu?"
Jotaro interrupted.
"We don't have to let him have the horse, do we?"
Otsu could have hugged the boy. As far as she was concerned, it was not so much a question of the horse as it was of preventing this monster from progressing any faster.
"That's true," she said. "I'm sure you're in a hurry, sir, but so are we. You can hire one of the horses that travel up and down the mountain regularly. Just as the boy says, it's unfair to try to take our horse away from us."
"I won't get off," Jotaro repeated. "I'll die before I do." "You've set your mind on not letting me have the horse?"
Baiken asked gruffly.
"You should have known we wouldn't to begin with," replied Jotaro gravely.
"Son of a bitch!"
shouted Baiken, infuriated by the boy's tone. Jotaro, tightening his grip on the horse's mane, looked little bigger than a flea. Baiken reached up, took hold of his leg, and started to pull him off. Now, of all times, was the moment for Jotaro to put his wooden sword to use, but in his confusion he forgot all about the weapon. Faced with an enemy so much stronger than himself, the only defense that came to mind was to spit in Baiken's face, which he did again and again. Otsu was filled with grim terror. The fear of being injured or killed by this man brought an acid, dry taste to her mouth. But there was no question of giving in and letting him have the horse. Musashi was being pursued. The longer she could delay this fiend, the more time Musashi would have to flee. It didn't matter to her that the distance between him and herself would also be increased, just at a time when she knew at least that they were on the same road. Biting her lip, then screaming, "You can't do this!" she struck Baiken in the chest with a force that not even she realized she possessed. Baiken, still wiping the spit off his face, was thrown off balance, and in that instant, Otsu's hand caught the hilt of his sword. "Bitch!" he barked, grabbing for her wrist. Then he howled with pain, for the sword was already partly out of its scabbard, and instead of Otsu's arm, he'd squeezed his hand around the blade. The tips of two fingers on his right hand dropped to the ground. Holding his bleeding hand, he sprang back, unintentionally pulling the sword from its scabbard. The brilliant glitter of steel extending from Otsu's hand scratched across the ground, coming to rest behind her. Baiken had blundered even worse than the night before. Cursing himself for his lack of caution, he struggled to regain his footing. Otsu, now afraid of nothing, swung the blade sideways at him. But it was a great wide-bladed weapon, nearly 3 feet long, which not every man would have been able to handle easily. When Baiken dodged, her hands wobbled and she staggered forward. She felt a quick wrenching of her wrists, and reddish-black blood spurted into her face. After a moment of dizziness, she realized the sword had cut into the rump of the horse. The wound was not deep, but the horse let out a fearsome noise, rearing and kicking wildly. Baiken, yelling unintelligibly, got hold of Otsu's wrist and tried to recover his sword, but at that moment, the horse kicked them both into the air. Then, rising on her hind legs, she whinnied loudly and shot off down the road like an arrow from a bow, Jotaro clinging grimly to her back and blood spewing out behind. Baiken stumbled around in the dust-laden air. He knew he couldn't catch the crazed beast, so his enraged eyes turned toward the place where Otsu had been. She wasn't there. After a moment, he spotted his sword at the foot of a larch tree and with a lunge retrieved it. As he straightened up, something clicked in his mind. There must be some connection between this woman and Musashi, and if she was Musashi's friend, she would make excellent bait. At the very least, she would know where he was going. Half running, half sliding down the embankment next to the road, he strode around a thatched farmhouse, peering under the floor and into the storehouse, while an old woman stooped like a hunchback behind a spinning wheel inside the house looked on in terror. Then he caught sight of Otsu racing through a thick grove of cryptomeria trees toward the valley beyond, where there were patches of late snow. Thundering down the hill with the force of a landslide, he soon closed the distance between them. "Bitch!" he cried, stretching out his left hand and touching her hair. Otsu dropped to the ground and caught hold of the roots of a tree, but her foot slipped, and her body fell over the edge of the cliff, where it swayed like a pendulum. Dirt and pebbles fell into her face as she looked up at Baiken's large eyes and his gleaming sword. "Fool!" he said contemptuously. "Do you think you can get away now?" Otsu glanced downward. 50 or 60 feet below, a stream cut through the floor of the valley. Curiously, she was not afraid, for she saw the valley as her salvation. At any moment she chose, she could escape simply by letting go of the tree and throwing herself on the mercy of the open space below. She felt death was near, but rather than dwell on that, her mind focused on a single image, Musashi. She seemed to see him now, his face like a full moon in a stormy sky. Baiken quickly seized her wrists and, hoisting her up, dragged her well clear of the edge. Just then, one of his henchmen called to him from the road.
"What are you doing down there? We'd better move fast. The old man at the tea house back there said a samurai woke him up before dawn this morning, ordered a box lunch, then ran off toward Kaga Valley."
"Kaga Valley?"
"That's what he said. But whether he goes that way or crosses Mount Tsuchi to Minakuchi doesn't matter. The roads come together at Ishibe. If we make good time to Yasugawa, we should be able to catch him there."
Baiken's back was turned to the man, his eyes fastened on Otsu, who crouched before him, seemingly trapped by his fierce glare.
"Ho!" he roared. "All three of you come down here!"
"Why?"
"Get down here fast!"
"If we waste time, Musashi'll beat us to Yasugawa."
"Never mind that."
The three men were among those who had been engaged in the fruitless search the night before. Used to making their way through the mountains, they stormed down the incline with the speed of so many boars. As they reached the ledge where Baiken was standing, they caught sight of Otsu. Their leader rapidly explained the situation to them.
"All right now, tie her up and bring her along," said Baiken,
before darting off through the woods. They tied her up, but they couldn't help feeling sorry for her. She lay helpless on the ground, face turned to the side. They stole embarrassed looks at her pale profile. Baiken was already in Kaga Valley. He stopped, looked back at the cliff, and shouted,
"We'll meet in Yasugawa. I'll take a shortcut, but you stay on the highway. And keep your eyes peeled."
"Yes, sir,"
they chorused back. Baiken, running between the rocks like a mountain goat, was soon out of sight. Jotaro was hurtling down the high road. Despite her age, the horse was so maddened there was no stopping her with a mere rope, even if Jotaro had known how to go about it. The raw wound burning like a torch, she sped blindly ahead, up hill, down dale, through villages. It was only through sheer luck that Jotaro avoided being thrown off.
"Watch out! Watch out! Watch out!"
he screamed repeatedly. The words had become a litany. No longer able to stay on by clinging to the mane, he had his arms locked tightly around the horse's neck. His eyes were closed. When the beast's rump rose in the air, so did Jotaro's. As it became increasingly apparent that his shouts were not working, his pleas gradually gave way to a distressed wail. When he had begged Otsu to let him ride a horse just once, he had been thinking how grand it would be to go galloping about at will on a splendid steed. But after a few minutes of this hair-raising ride, he had had his fill. Jotaro hoped that someone, anyone, would bravely volunteer to seize the flying rope and bring the horse to a halt. In this, he was over-optimistic, for neither travelers nor villagers wanted to risk being hurt in an affair that was no concern of theirs. Far from helping, everyone made for the safety of the roadside and shouted abuse at what appeared to them to be an irresponsible horseman. In no time, he'd passed the village of Mikumo and reached the inn town of Natsumi. If he had been an expert rider and perfect control of his mount, he could have shaded his eyes and calmly looked out over the beautiful mountains and valleys of Iga, the peaks of Nunobiki, the Yokota River, and, in the distance, the mirror-like waters of Lake Biwa.
"Stop! Stop! Stop!"
The words of his litany had changed. His tone was more distraught. As they started down Koji Hill, his cry abruptly changed again.
"Help!"
he screamed. The horse charged on down the precipitous incline, Jotaro bouncing like a ball on her back. About a third of the way down, a large oak projected from a cliff on the left, one of its smaller branches extending across the road. When Jotaro felt the leaves against his face, he grabbed with both hands, believing the gods had heard his prayer and caused the limb to stretch out before him. Perhaps he was right. He jumped like a frog, and the next instant he was hanging in the air, his hands firmly wrapped around the branch above his head. The horse went out from under him, moving a little faster now that she was riderless. It was no more than a 10-foot drop to the ground, but Jotaro could not bring himself to release his grip. In his badly shaken condition, he saw the short distance to the ground as a yawning abyss and hung on to the branch for dear life, crossing his legs over it, readjusting his aching hands, and wondering feverishly what to do. The problem was solved for him when, with a loud crack, the branch broke off. For an awful instant, Jotaro thought he was done for. A second later, he was sitting on the ground unharmed. "Phew!" was all he could say. For a few minutes, he sat inertly, his spirit dampened, if not broken, but then he remembered why he was there and jumped up. Heedless of the ground he had covered, he shouted, "Otsu!" He ran back up the slope, one hand firmly around his wooden sword. What could have happened to her? "Otsu! Otsu!" Presently, he met a man in a grayish-red kimono coming down the hill. The stranger wore a leather hakama and carried two swords, but had on no cloak. After passing Jotaro, he looked over his shoulder and said,
"Hello there."
Jotaro turned and the man asked,
"Is something wrong?"
"You came from over the hill, didn't you?" Jotaro asked.
"Yes."
"Did you see a pretty woman about 20 years old?"
"I did, as a matter of fact."
"Where?"
"In Natsumi. I saw some freebooters walking along with a girl. Her arms were tied behind her, which naturally struck me as strange, but I had no reason to interfere. I dare say the men were from Tsujikaze Kohei's gang. He moved a whole village of hoodlums from Yasugawa to Suzuka Valley some years ago."
"That was her, I'm sure." Jotaro started to walk on, but the man stopped him.
"Were you traveling together?"
he asked. "Yes, her name's Otsu."
"If you take foolish risks, you'll get yourself killed before you can help anybody. Why don't you wait here? They'll come this way sooner or later. For now, tell me what this is all about. I may be able to give you some advice."
The boy immediately placed his trust in the man and told him everything that had happened since morning. From time to time, the man nodded under his basket hat. When the story ended, he said,
"I understand your predicament. But even with your courage, a woman and a boy are no match for Kohei's men. I think I'd better rescue Otsu, is that her name, for you."
"Would they hand her over to you?"
"Maybe not for the mere asking, but I'll think about that when the time comes. Meanwhile, you hide in a thicket and stay quiet."
While Jotaro selected a clump of bushes and hid behind it, the man continued briskly on down the hill. For a moment, Jotaro wondered if he had been deceived. Had the ronin just said a few words to cheer him up, then moved on to save his own neck? Seized by anxiety, he lifted his head above the shrubs, but hearing voices, ducked down again. A minute or two later, Otsu came into view, surrounded by the three men, her hands tied firmly behind her. Blood was encrusted on a cut on her white foot. One of the ruffians, shoving Otsu forward by the shoulder, growled,
"What are you looking around for? Walk faster!"
"That's right, walk!"
"I'm looking for my traveling companion. What could have happened to him? Jotaro!"
"Quiet!"
Jotaro was all set to yell and jump out of his hiding place when the ronin came back, this time without his basket hat. He was 26 or 27, and of a darkish complexion. In his eyes was a purposeful look that strayed neither right nor left. As he trotted up the incline, he was saying, as if to himself,
"It's terrifying, really terrifying!"
When he passed Otsu and her captors, he mumbled a greeting and hastened on, but the men stopped.
"Hey!"
one of them called.
"Aren't you Watanabe's nephew? What's so terrifying?"
Watanabe was the name of an old family in the district, the present head of which was Watanabe Hanzo, a highly respected practitioner of the occult martial tactics known collectively as ninjutsu.
"Haven't you heard?"
"Heard what?"
Down at the bottom of this hill, there's a samurai named Miyamoto Musashi, all ready for a big fight. He's standing in the middle of the road with his sword unsheathed, questioning everybody who passes by. He has the fiercest eyes I ever saw.
Musashi's doing that?
That's right. He came straight up to me and asked my name, so I told him that I was Tsuge Sannojo, the nephew of Watanabe Hanzo, and that I came from Iga. He apologized and let me by. He was very polite, in fact. Said as long as I wasn't connected with Tsujikaze Kohei, it was all right.
Oh?
I asked him what had happened. He said Kohei was on the road with his henchmen, out to catch him and kill him. He decided to entrench himself where he was and meet the attack there. He seemed prepared to fight to the finish.
Are you telling the truth, Sannojo?
Of course I am. Why would I lie to you?
The faces of the three grew pale. They looked at each other nervously, uncertain as to their next move.
You'd better be careful,
said Sannojo, ostensibly resuming his trip up the hill.
Sannojo!
What?
I don't know what we should do.
Even our boss said this Musashi is unusually strong.
Well, he does seem to have a lot of confidence in himself. When he came up to me with that sword, I certainly didn't feel like taking him on. What do you think we should do? We're taking this woman to Yasugawa on the boss's orders.
I don't see that has anything to do with me.
Don't be like that. Lend us a hand.
Not on your life. If I helped you and my uncle found out about it, he'd disown me. I could, of course, give you a bit of advice.
Well, speak up. What do you think we should do?
For one thing, you could tie that woman up to a tree and leave her. That way, you could move faster.
Anything else?
You shouldn't take this road. It's a little farther, but you could go up the valley road to Yasugawa and let people there know about all this. Then you could surround Musashi and gradually hem him in.
That's not a bad idea. But be very, very careful. Musashi will be fighting for his life, and he'll take quite a few souls with him when he goes. You'd rather avoid that, wouldn't you?
Quickly agreeing with Sannojo's suggestion, they dragged Otsu to a grove and tied her rope to a tree. Then they left, but after a few minutes returned to tie a gag in her mouth.
That should do it,
said one.
Let's get going!
They dived into the woods. Jotaro, squatting behind his leafy screen, waited judiciously before raising his head for a look around. He saw no one, no travelers, no freebooters, no Sannojo.
Otsu!
He called, prancing out of the thicket. Quickly finding her, he undid her bonds and took her hand. They ran to the road.
Let's get away from here,
he urged.
What were you doing hiding in the bushes?
Never mind, let's go.
Just a minute,
said Otsu, stopping to pat her hair, straighten her collar, and rearrange her obi. Jotaro clicked his tongue.
This is no time for primping, he wailed. Can't you fix your hair later? But that ronin said Musashi was at the bottom of the hill. Is that why you have to stop and make yourself pretty?
No, of course not, said Otsu, defending herself with almost comic seriousness.
But if Musashi is so near, we don't have anything to worry about. And since our troubles are as good as over, I feel calm and safe enough to think of my appearance.
Do you believe that ronin really saw Musashi?
Of course. By the way, where is he?
He just disappeared. He's sort of strange, isn't he?
Shall we go now? Said Otsu.
Sure you're pretty enough?
Jotaro!
Just teasing. You look so happy.
You look happy too.
I am, and I don't try to hide it the way you do. I'll shout it so everybody can hear. I'm happy! He did a little dance, waving his arms and kicking his legs, then said,
It'll be very disappointing if Musashi isn't there, won't it? I think I'll run on ahead and see.
Otsu took her time. Her heart had already flown to the bottom of the slope faster than Jotaro could ever have run.
I look frightful,
she thought, as she surveyed her injured foot and the dirt and leaves stuck to her sleeves.
Come on, called Jotaro. Why are you poking along?
From the lilt in his voice, Otsu felt certain that he had spotted Musashi. At last, she thought. Until now, she'd had to seek comfort within herself, and she was tired of it. She felt a measure of pride, both in herself and toward the gods, for having remained true to her purpose. Now that she was about to see Musashi again, her spirit was dancing with joy. This elation, she knew, was that of anticipation. She could not predict whether Musashi would accept her devotion. Her joy at the prospect of meeting him was only slightly tarnished by a gnawing premonition that the encounter might bring sadness. On the shady slope of Koji Hill, the ground was frozen, but at the tea shop near the bottom, it was so warm flies were flying around. This was an inn town, so of course the shop sold tea to travelers. It also carried a line of miscellaneous goods required by the farmers of the district, from cheap sweets to straw boots for oxen. Jotaro stood in front of the shop, a small boy in a large and noisy crowd.
"Where's Musashi?"
she looked around searchingly.
"He's not here," replied Jotaro dispiritedly.
"Not here? He must be."
"Well, I can't find him anywhere, and the shopkeeper said he hasn't seen a samurai like that around. There must have been some mistake."
Jotaro, though disappointed, was not despondent. Otsu would have readily admitted that she had no reason on earth to expect as much as she had, but the nonchalance of Jotaro's reply annoyed her. Shocked and a little angry at his lack of concern, she said,
"Did you look for him over there?"
"Yes."
"How about behind the Koshin milepost?"
"I looked. He's not there."
"Behind the tea shop? I told you he isn't here."
Otsu turned her face away from him.
"Are you crying?"
he asked.
"It's none of your business," she said sharply.
"I don't understand you. You seem to be sensible most of the time, but sometimes you act like a baby. How could we know if Sannojo's story was true or not? You decided all by yourself that it was, and now that you find it wasn't, you burst into tears."
"Women are crazy,"
Jotaro exclaimed, bursting into laughter.
Otsu felt like sitting down right there and giving up. In an instant, the light had gone out of her life. She felt as bereft of hope as before. No, more so.
The decaying milk teeth in Jotaro's laughing mouth disgusted her. Angrily, she asked herself why she had to drag a child like this around with her anyway. The urge swept over her to abandon him right there. True, he was also searching for Musashi, but he loved him only as a teacher. To her, Musashi was life itself. Jotaro could laugh everything off and return to his normal, cheerful self in no time, but Otsu would for days be deprived of the energy to go on. Somewhere in Jotaro's youthful mind, there was the blithe certainty that one day, sooner or later, he'd find Musashi again. Otsu had no such belief in a happy ending. Having been too optimistic about seeing Musashi today, she was now swinging toward the opposite extreme, asking herself if life would go on like this forever, without her ever again seeing or talking to the man she loved. Those who love seek a philosophy and, because of this, are fond of solitude. In Otsu's case, orphan that she was, there was also the keen sense of isolation from others. In response to Jotaro's indifference, she frowned and marched silently away from the tea shop.
"Otsu!"
The voice was Sannojo's. He emerged from behind the Koshin milepost and came toward her through the withered underbrush. His scabbards were damp.
"You weren't telling the truth,"
Jotaro said accusingly.
"What do you mean?"
"You said Musashi was waiting at the bottom of the hill. You lied!"
"Don't be stupid,"
said Sannojo reproachfully.
"It was because of that lie that Otsu was able to escape, wasn't it? What are you complaining about? Shouldn't you be thanking me?"
"You just made up that story to fool those men?"
"Of course."
Turning triumphantly to Otsu, Jotaro said, "See? Didn't I tell you?" Otsu felt she had a perfect right to be angry with Jotaro, but there was no reason to nurse a grudge against Sannojo. She bowed to him several times and thanked him profusely for having saved her.
"Those hoodlums from Suzuka are a lot tamer than they used to be," said Sannojo. "But if they're out to waylay somebody, he's not likely to get over this road safely. Still, from what I hear about this Musashi you're so worried about, it sounds to me like he's too smart to stumble into one of their traps."
"Are there other roads besides this one to Omi?" asked Otsu.
"There are,"
replied Sannojo, raising his eyes toward the mountain peaks, sparkling dazzlingly in the midday sun.
"If you go to Iga Valley, there's a road to Ueno, and from Ano Valley, there's one that goes to Yokkaichi and Kuwana. There must be 3 or 4 other mountain paths and shortcuts. My guess is Musashi left the high road early on."
"Then you think he's still safe?"
"Most likely. At least safer than the two of you. You've been rescued once today, but if you stay on this highway, Tsujikaze's men will catch you again at Yasugawa. If you can stand a rather steep climb, come with me, and I'll show you a path practically nobody knows."
They quickly assented.
Sannojo guided them up above Kaga Village to Makado Pass, from which a path led down to Seto in Otsu. After explaining in detail how to proceed, he said,
"You're out of harm's way now. Just keep your eyes and ears open, and be sure to find a safe place to stay before dark."
Otsu thanked him for all he had done and started to leave, but Sannojo stared at her and said,
"We're parting now, you know."
The words seemed fraught with meaning, and there was a rather hurt look in his eyes.
"All along," he continued, "I've been thinking, is she going to ask now? But you never did ask."
"Ask what?"
"My name."
"But I heard your name when we were on Koji Hill."
"Do you remember it?"
"Of course. You're Tsuge Sannojo, and you're the nephew of Watanabe Hanzo."
"Thank you. I don't ask you to be eternally grateful to me or anything like that, but I do hope you'll always remember me."
"Why, I'm deeply indebted to you."
"That's not what I mean. What I want to say is, well, I'm still not married. If my uncle weren't so strict, I'd like to take you to my home right now. But I can see you're in a hurry. Anyway, you'll find a small inn a few miles ahead where you can stay overnight. I know the innkeeper very well, so mention my name to him. Farewell."
After he was gone, a strange feeling came over Otsu. From the outset, she had not been able to figure out what sort of person Sannojo was, and when they had parted, she felt as though she had escaped from the clutches of a dangerous animal. She had gone through the motions of thanking him. She did not really feel grateful in her heart. Jotaro, in spite of his tendency to take to strangers, reacted in much the same way. As they started down from the pass, he said, "I don't like that man." Otsu did not want to speak badly of Sannojo behind his back, but she admitted she did not like him either, adding, "What do you suppose he meant by telling me that he was still single?"
"Oh, he's hinting that one day he's going to ask you to marry him."
"Why, that's absurd."
The two made their way to Kyoto without incident, albeit disappointed at not finding Musashi at any of the places where they had hoped to, neither on the lakeside in Omi, nor at the Kara Bridge in Seta, nor at the barrier in Osaka. From Keage, they plunged into the year-end crowds near the Sanjo Avenue entrance to the city. In the capital, the house fronts were adorned with the pine branch decorations traditional during the New Year season. The sight of the decorations cheered Otsu, who, instead of lamenting the lost chances of the past, resolved to look forward to the future and the opportunities it held for finding Musashi.
the great bridge at Gojo Avenue. The first day of the new year. If he did not show up that morning, then the second, or the third. He had said he would certainly be there, as she had learned from Jotaro. Even though he wasn't coming to meet her, just to be able to see him and talk to him again would be enough. The possibility that she might run into Matahachi was the darkest cloud shadowing her dream. According to Jotaro, Musashi's message had been delivered only to Akemi. Matahachi might never have received it. Otsu prayed that he hadn't, that Musashi would come, but not Matahachi. Otsu slowed her steps, thinking Musashi might be in the very crowd they were in. Then a chill ran up her spine and she started walking faster. Matahachi's dreadful mother might also materialize at any moment. Jotaro hadn't a care in the world. The colors and noises of the city, seen and heard after a long absence, exhilarated him to no end. "Are we going straight to an inn?" he asked apprehensively. "No, not yet." "Good. It'll be dull being indoors while it's still light out. Let's walk around some more. It looks like there's a market over there." "We haven't time to go to the market. We have important business to take care of."
"Business? We do? Have you forgotten the box you're carrying on your back?"
"Oh, that.
Yes, that.
I won't be able to relax until we've found Lord Karasumaru Mitsuhiro's mansion and delivered the scrolls to him."
"Are we going to stay at his house tonight?"
"Of course not," Otsu laughed, glancing toward the Kamo River. "Do you think a great nobleman like that would let a dirty little boy like you sleep under his roof, lice and all?" The Butterfly in Winter. Akemi slipped out of the inn at Sumiyoshi without telling anybody. She felt like a bird freed from its cage, but was still not sufficiently recovered from her brush with death to fly too high. The scars left by Seijiro's violence would not heal quickly. He had shattered her cherished dream of giving herself unblemished to the man she really loved. On the boat up the Yodo to Kyoto, she felt that all the waters of the river would not equal the tears she wanted to shed. As other boats, loaded with ornaments and supplies for the New Year celebration, rowed busily past, she stared at them and thought,
"Now, even if I do find Musashi..."
Her troubled eyes filled and overflowed. No one could ever know how eagerly she had anticipated the New Year's morning when she would find him on the great bridge at Gojo Avenue. Her longing for Musashi had grown deeper and stronger. The thread of love had lengthened, and she had wound it up into a ball inside her breast. Through all the years, she had gone on spinning the thread from distant memories and bits of hearsay and winding it around the ball to make it larger and larger. Until only a few days earlier, she had treasured her girlish sentiments and carried them with her, like a fresh wildflower from the slopes of Mount Ibuki. Now the blossom inside her was crushed. Though it was unlikely anyone was aware of what had occurred, she imagined everybody was looking at her with knowing eyes. In Kyoto, in the fading light of evening, Akemi walked among the leafless willows and miniature pagodas in Teramachi, near Gojo Avenue, looking as cold and forlorn as a butterfly in winter.
"Hey, beautiful," said a man. "Your obi cord is loose. Don't you want me to tie it for you?"
He was thin, shabbily clothed and uncouth of speech, but he wore the two swords of a samurai. Akemi had never seen him before, but habitués of the drinking places nearby could have told her that his name was Akakabe Yasoma, and that he hung around the back streets on winter nights doing nothing. His worn straw sandals flapped as he ran up behind Akemi and picked up the loose end of obi cord.
"What are you doing all by yourself in this deserted place? I don't suppose you're one of those mad women who appear in the Kyōgen plays, are you? You've got a pretty face." Why don't you fix your hair up a little and stroll about like the other girls?
Akemi walked on, pretending to have no ears, but Yasuma mistook this for shyness.
You look like a city girl. What did you do? Run away from home? Or do you have a husband you're trying to escape from?
Akemi made no reply.
You should be careful. A pretty girl like you, wandering around in a daze, looking as though you're in trouble or something. You can't tell what might happen. We don't have the kind of thieves and ruffians who used to hang around Rashomon, but there are plenty of freebooters, and their mouths water at the sight of a woman. And vagrants, too. And people who buy and sell women.
Although Akemi said not a word, Yasuma persisted, answering his own questions when necessary.
It's really quite dangerous. They say women from Kyoto are being sold for very high prices in Edo now. A long time ago, they used to take women from here up to Hiraizumi in the northeast, but now it's Edo. That's because the second shogun, Hidetada, is building up the city as fast as he can. The brothels in Kyoto are all opening up branches there now.
Akemi said nothing.
You'd stand out anywhere, so you should be careful. If you don't watch out, you might get involved with some scoundrel. It's terribly dangerous.
Akemi had had enough. Throwing her sleeves up on her shoulders in anger, she turned and hissed loudly at him. Yasuma just laughed.
You know, he said, I think you really are crazy.
Shut up and go away.
Well, aren't you?
You're the crazy one.
Ha ha ha! That as much as proves it. You're crazy. I feel sorry for you.
If you don't get out of here, I'll throw a rock at you.
Aw, you don't want to do that, do you?
Go away, you beast!
The proud front she was putting up masked the terror she actually felt. She screamed at Yasuma and ran into a field of miscanthus, where once had stood Lord Komatsu's mansion and its garden filled with stone lanterns. She seemed to swim through the swaying plants.
Wait!
Cried Yasuma, going after her like a hunting dog. Above Toribe Hill rose the evening moon, looking like the wild grin of a she-demon. There was no one in the immediate vicinity. The nearest people were about 300 yards away, in a group slowly descending a hill, but they wouldn't have come to her rescue, even if they had heard her shouts, for they were returning from a funeral. Clad in formal white clothing and hats tied with white ribbons, they carried their prayer beads in their hands. A few of them were still weeping. Suddenly, Akemi, pushed sharply from behind, stumbled and fell.
Oh, I'm sorry, said Yasuma.
He fell on top of her, apologizing all the while.
Did it hurt?
He asked solicitously, hugging her to him. Seething with anger, Akemi slapped his bearded face, but this did not faze him. Indeed, he seemed to like it. He merely squinted and grinned as she struck. Then he hugged her more closely and rubbed his cheek against hers. His beard felt like a thousand needles sticking into her skin. She could barely breathe. As she scratched desperately at him, one of her fingernails clawed the inside of his nose, bringing forth a stream of blood. Still, Yasuma did not relax the tight hold he had on her. The bell at the Amida Hall on Toribe Hill was tolling a dirge, a lamentation on the impermanence of all things and the vanity of life. But it made no impression on the two struggling mortals. The withered miscanthus waved violently with their movements.
"Calm down, stop fighting," he pleaded. "There's nothing to be afraid of. I'll make you my bride." "You'd like that, wouldn't you?"
Akemi screamed.
"I just want to die!"
The misery in her voice startled Yasuma.
"Why? What's the matter?"
he stammered. Akemi's crouching position, with her hands, knees, and chest drawn tightly together, resembled the bud of a sasanqua flower. Yasuma began to comfort and cajole, hoping to soothe her into surrender. This did not seem to be the first time he had encountered a situation of this sort. On the contrary, it would appear that this was something he liked, for his face shone with pleasure, without losing its menacing quality. He was in no hurry. Like a cat, he enjoyed playing with his victim.
"Don't cry," he said. "There's nothing to cry about, is there?"
Giving her a kiss on the ear, he went on,
"You must have been with a man before. At your age, you couldn't be innocent."
Seijuro.
Akemi recalled how stifled and miserable she had been before, how the framework of the shoji had blurred before her eyes.
"Wait,"
she said.
"Wait? All right.
I'll wait," he said, mistaking the warmth of her feverish body for passion.
"But don't try to run away, or I'll really get rough."
With a sharp grunt, she twisted her shoulders and shook his hand off her. Glaring into his face, she slowly rose.
"What are you trying to do to me?"
"You know what I want."
"You think you can treat women like fools, don't you? All you men do. Well, I may be a woman, but I've got spirit."
Blood seeped from her lip where she had cut it on a miscanthus leaf. Biting the lip, she burst into fresh tears.
"You say the strangest things," he said. "What else can you be but crazy?"
"I'll say whatever I please," she screamed.
Pushing his chest away from her with all her might, she scrambled away through the miscanthus, which stretched as far as she could see in the moonlight.
"Murder! Help! Murder!"
Yasuma lunged after her. Before she had gone 10 steps, he caught her and threw her down again. Her white legs visible beneath her kimono, her hair falling around her face, she lay with her cheek pressed against the ground. Her kimono was half open, and her white breasts felt the cold wind. Just as Yasuma was about to leap on her, something very hard landed in the vicinity of his ear. Blood rushed to his head, and he screamed out in pain. As he took to look, the hard object came crashing down on the crown of his head. This time, there could hardly have been any pain, for he immediately fell over unconscious, his head shaking emptily like a paper tiger's. As he lay there with his mouth slack, his assailant, a mendicant priest, stood over him, holding the shakuhachi with which he had dealt the blows.
"The evil brute," he said, "but he went down easier than I expected."
The priest looked at Yasuma for a time, debating whether it would be kinder to kill him outright. The chances were that even if he recovered consciousness, he would never be sane again. Akemi stared blankly at her rescuer. Apart from the shakuhachi, there was nothing to identify him as a priest. To judge from his dirty clothes and the sword hanging at his side, he might have been a poverty-stricken samurai, or even a beggar.
"It's all right now," he said. "You don't have to worry anymore."
Recovering from her daze, Akemi thanked him and began straightening her hair and her kimono, but she peered into the darkness around her with eyes still full of fright.
"Where do you live?"
asked the priest.
"Huh? Live? Do you mean, where's my house?" she said, covering her face with her hands.
Through her sobs, she tried to answer his questions, but she found herself unable to be honest with him. Part of what she told him was true. Her mother was different from her. Her mother was trying to exchange her body for money. She had fled here from Sumiyoshi. But the rest was made up on the spur of the moment.
"I'd rather die than go back home," she wailed. "I've had to put up with so much from my mother. I've been shamed in so many ways. Why, even when I was a little girl, I had to go out on the battlefield and steal things from the bodies of dead soldiers."
Her loathing for her mother made her bones tremble. Aoki Tanzaemon helped her along to a little hollow, where it was quiet and the wind less chilly. Coming to a small, dilapidated temple, he flashed a toothy grin and said,
"This is where I live. It's not much, but I like it."
Though aware that it was a little rude, Akemi could not help saying, "Do you really live here?" Tanzaemon pushed open a grill door and motioned for her to enter. Akemi hesitated.
"It's warmer inside than you'd think," he said. "All I have to cover the floor with is thin straw matting. Still, that's better than nothing. Are you afraid I might be like that brute back there?"
Silently, Akemi shook her head. Tanzaemon did not frighten her. She felt sure he was a good man, and anyway, he was getting on, over 50, she thought. What held her back was the filthiness of the little temple and the smell of Tanzaemon's body and clothing. But there was nowhere else to go. No telling what might happen if Yasuma or someone like him were to find her. And her forehead was burning with fever.
"I won't be a bother to you?" she asked as she went up the steps.
"Not at all. No one will mind if you stay here for months."
The building was pitch black, the kind of atmosphere favored by bats.
"Wait just a minute," said Tanzaemon.
She heard the scratching of metal against flint, and then a small lamp, which she must have scavenged somewhere, cast a feeble light. She looked about and saw that this strange man had somehow accumulated the basic necessities for housekeeping: a pot or two, some dishes, a wooden pillow, some straw matting. Saying he would make a little buckwheat gruel for her, he began puttering around with a broken earthenware brazier, first putting in a little charcoal, then some sticks, and after raising a few sparks, blowing them into a flame.
"He's a nice old man," thought Akemi,
as she began to feel calmer. The place no longer seemed so filthy.
"There now," he said. "You look feverish, and you said you were tired. You've probably caught a cold. Why don't you just lie down over there until the food is ready?"
He pointed to a makeshift pallet of straw matting and rice sacks. Akemi spread some paper she had with her on the wooden pillow, and with murmured apologies for resting while he worked, laid down. For cover, there were the tattered remains of a mosquito net. She started to pull this over her, but as she did so, an animal with glittering eyes jumped out from under it and bounded over her head. Akemi screamed and buried her face in the pallet.
Tanzaemon was more astonished than Akemi. He dropped the sack from which he was pouring flour into the water, spilling half of it on his knees. "What was that?" he cried.
Akemi, still hiding her face, said, "I don't know. It seemed bigger than a rat."
"Probably a squirrel. They sometimes come when they smell food, but I don't see it anywhere."
Lifting her head slightly, Akemi said, "There it is."
"Where?"
Tanzaemon straightened up and turned around. Perched on the railing of the inner sanctum, from which the image of the Buddha was long gone, was a small monkey, shrinking with fright under Tanzaemon's hard stare. Tanzaemon looked puzzled, but the monkey apparently decided there was nothing to fear. After a few trips up and down the faded vermilion railing, he sat down again, and turning up a face like a peach with long hair, began blinking his eyes.
"Where do you suppose he came from?" "Aha! I see now. I thought a good deal of rice had been scattered around."
He moved toward the monkey, but the latter, anticipating his approach, bounded behind the sanctum and hid.
"He's a cute little devil," said Tanzaemon. "If we give him something to eat, he probably won't do any mischief. Let's let him be."
Brushing the flour off his knees, he sat down before the brazier again.
"There's nothing to be afraid of, Akemi. Get some rest."
"Do you think he'll behave himself?"
"Yes, he's not wild. He must be somebody's pet. There's nothing to worry about. Are you warm enough?"
"Yes."
"Then get some sleep. That's the best cure for a cold."
He put more flour in the water and stirred the gruel with chopsticks. The fire was burning briskly now, and while the mixture was heating up, he began chopping some scallions. His chopping board was the top of an old table, his knife a small rusted dagger. With unwashed hands, he scooped the scallions into a wooden bowl and then wiped off the chopping block,
converting it into a tray. The bubbling of the boiling pot gradually warmed the room. Seated with his arms around his spindly knees, the former samurai gazed at the broth with hungry eyes. He looked happy and eager, as though the pot before him contained the ultimate pleasure of mankind. The bell of Kiyomizu-dera pealed as it did every night. The winter austerities, which lasted 30 days, had ended, and the new year was at hand. But as always, as the year drew to a close, the burden on people's souls seemed to grow heavier. Far into the night, supplicants were sounding the tinny gong above the temple entrance as they bowed to pray, and wailing chants invoking the Buddha's aid droned on monotonously. While Tanzaemon slowly stirred the gruel to keep it from scorching, he turned reflective.
I myself am receiving my punishment and atoning for my sins, but what has happened to Jotaro?
The child did nothing blameworthy.
Oh, blessed Kannong, I beg you to punish the parent for his sins, but cast the eye of generous compassion on the son.
A scream suddenly punctuated his prayer.
You beast!
Her eyes still closed in sleep, her face pressed hard against the wooden pillow, Akemi was weeping bitterly. She ranted on until the sound of her own voice woke her.
Was I talking in my sleep? She asked.
Yes, you startled me, said Tanzaemon,
coming to her bedside and wiping her forehead with a cool rag.
You're sweating terribly. Must be the fever.
What did I say?
Oh, a lot of things.
What sort of things?
Akemi's feverish face grew redder from embarrassment. She pulled the cover up over it. Without answering directly, Tanzaemon said,
Akemi, there's a man you'd like to put a curse on, isn't there?
Did I say that?
What happened? Did he desert you?
No.
I see,
he said, jumping to his own conclusion. Akemi, pushing herself up into a half-sitting position, said,
Oh, what should I do now? Tell me, what?
She had vowed she would reveal her secret shame to no one, but the anger and sadness, the sense of loss pent up inside her, were too much to bear alone. She sprawled on Tanzaemon's knee and blurted out the whole story, sobbing and moaning throughout.
Oh, she wailed finally, I want to die! Die! Let me die!
Tanzaemon's breath grew hot. It had been a long time since he had been this close to a woman. Her odor burned his nostrils, his eyes. Desires of the flesh, which he thought he had overcome, began to swell as from an influx of warm blood, and his body, until now no more vibrant than a barren, withered tree, took on new life. He was reminded, for a change, that there were lungs and a heart underneath his ribs. He muttered.
So that's the kind of man Yoshioka Seijuro is.
Bitter hatred for Seijuro welled up in him. Nor was it only indignation. A kind of jealousy moved him to tighten his shoulders, as though it were a daughter of his own who had been violated. As Akemi writhed in tears on his knee, he experienced a feeling of intimacy, and a look of perplexity crept into his face.
Now there, don't cry. Your heart is still chaste. It's not as if you'd permitted this man to make love to you, nor did you return his love. What's important to a woman is not her body, but her heart. And chastity itself is a matter of the inner being. Even when a woman doesn't give herself to a man, if she regards him with lust, she becomes, at least as long as the feeling lasts, unchaste and unclean.
Akemi was not comforted by these abstract words. Hot tears seeped through the priest's kimono, and she went on repeating that she wanted to die.
Now, stop crying,
said Tanzaimon again, patting her on the back. But the trembling of her white neck did not move him to genuine sympathy. This soft skin, so sweet to the smell, had already been stolen from him by another man. Noticing that the monkey had sneaked up,